Please, everyone, please help me welcome our speaker, Rob W., coming in from Maine, the Brunswick Group. Thank you, Rob.
Hi, everybody. I'm Rob. I'm an alcoholic. It's a big group. I pulled in the parking lot. I'm like, oh, no. I don't mind. Thank you for that laughter. It just took about 10 pounds of weight off of me. Really grateful to be here tonight. I want to thank Jeff for asking me to come down and share what my experience is, and hopefully I can shed a little hope on some of you out here that might not be feeling much hope tonight, I want to thank Rich, wherever he is, for scrubbing his house down today. Yesterday, he was a great host, and he scrubbed his house in preparation to put us up for the night. And we stayed in the Executive Inn up the road, which is a nice place. But I want to thank him for doing that. And it's just good to see a lot. I've didn't quite recognize Dave and Paul and a couple other guys that I've met along the way this last couple years. But it's good to see everybody. It's good to see this group. I walked in this room tonight and I just felt this energy. And it felt good. I've walked into a lot of meetings and have not felt that, I see a lot of sad, I walk into some meetings, see a lot of sad faces, and don't hear a lot of hope. And I didn't have a lot to contribute most of the time, because I was coming to meetings to see what I could get from you, and I wasn't really concerned about what I could give back. My sobriety date is January 14th, 1988, and my first 19 years of sobriety. We talk about we get up here and we're supposed to share what was like, what happened was like. Now, and my story kind of is about what it was like. And then what happened, and then what it was like the first 19 years, and then what it's been like this last 2 years. It's been a whole new ball game, and I'll back up a little bit. Am I like going this the whole hour thing? Okay. A little over 2 years ago, I could not imagine ever getting in front of a group of people and talking for an hour. And I've done this maybe 10 times. Now, in this last 2 years, maybe 15 times, and I at the end of the hour, I'm like, where'd that go? Why did I talk so much about the drinking? I really love the sobriety stuff, and to let you know that I do qualify to be here. And the qualification in the big book that I find is, in the chapter We Agnostics, it says if, I got this mental obsession, when I'm feeling restless, irritable, and discontent, I think of a drink. And I heard a speaker just a couple weeks ago talk about, just the thought of a drink used to make me go, it was a rough day, something's going on. Just the thought that I was going to have that drink sometime later on that afternoon made me feel good. And then the other part is, when I start putting alcohol in my body, I got this phenomenon of craving that the big book talks about. And, I'm the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I was very rarely mildly intoxicated. I was like the guy streaking across the Pizza Hut for $5, Jeff and I were talking about, this craziness, this insanity, this craziness I used to live when I was drinking. It used to be like a badge of honor, to be the nut, and I love that. I just love that title, to be the craziest guy. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan. Go Red Wings. Sorry, guys. My mom and dad got divorced when I was like 5 years old. And my dad moved out to California. My mom immediately married my stepdad. And, that was like my first resentments going on right there. And, I had one sister, for my younger years into my early teens, I thought fairly normal, I just played sports with all the guys around my neighborhood, and, You know, I didn't like drugs. You know, a lot of guys at school were doing a lot of drugs, and that stuff didn't excite me at all. I wasn't real popular in school. I didn't hang out with anybody there. The drinking stuff, I knew people in school were doing it, but it didn't really faze me. I hated cigarettes. I was, like, really into being healthy and just being a kid and playing. And looking back on it today, I know why I liked it so much, is because I was, like, the guy in charge of the neighborhood. And everybody did what Rob wanted to do, you know. And if I didn't like you this particular day, you weren't playing ball with us. Sorry, you know. Until I was like 16, this other guy moved in the neighborhood, and everybody started following him, and there was another resentment. And my sister started doing drugs, and, you know, I'd walk through the house, and she'd be sitting in a room on the floor staring at her hands and talking about the bones she could see in her hands. And I'm like, whatever, you know. And about that same time, my mom discovered my sister was dating this guy that she worked with. My sister's like 17, this guy's like 28, and this guy was actually like one of my mom's drinking buddies at work, and that kind of upset my mom, so her drinking took off. And I'd come home in the late afternoon. My stepdad would just tell me to go to bed, go to my room, everything's cool, I'd see these plates sticking in the walls. You know, my mom was emptying the china cabinet, with her anger. And I would just, I was like, this isn't right. Something's going on. This isn't right. But that new guy moved in the neighborhood. They had a liquor cabinet down in his basement. And we used to go down there and play pool. And we started just hitting the liquor cabinet every once in a while. I can't remember what I first drank or how much of it I drank. But I do remember, that warm glow that came over me. I remember just particularly going home that night. I didn't care what was going on there. I just went into my room. And the room was spinning, and I've heard a lot of people that don't like that, and I absolutely loved it. I loved that free ride. But that was it. My parents didn't like my drinking, and I had one uncle who was, like, really cool with his drinking. He used to build hot rods in his garage, and he had the beer or the keg inside the refrigerator with the tap coming outside, the frozen mugs up in the freezer. He'd crank, tunes. Man, that was fun. I liked that. My mom didn't like that. And I'd come home at night. My parents were getting down on my case, so I was like, heck with this. I'm going to go live with Dad. And I really hadn't drank a whole lot at that point, But I went out to California to meet my dad, who I hadn't seen since I was like 5 years old. At this time I was still very shy and around women, and I still really... drinking really wasn't that great, but still hated drugs and cigarettes and blah, blah, blah. I get out there, my dad's a full-blown alcoholic, and I can say that because I know he knew it. He handed me my first joint and shared me with his 36-year-old girlfriend, and it was just, this is cool. I love that. I used to brag about that, and that was extremely damaging to the rest of my early adult life, and even today, it's got a mark, But anyways, that only lasted a few months because he had rules too, and I didn't like any rules. I didn't like any rules so much that I joined the United States Navy to get away from all the rules. That's really where my drinking took off, It's like, because everybody, when they got out of work, would go get drunk and chase women. And that's what my life became, And to tell you the truth, from like about 1978 to about 1986, I really don't know. I remember being in Germany, and I remember being in, Paris, France, and some places in South America, and Iceland, and Bermuda, and Puerto Rico. I remember being all over the world, but what I remember of those places wasn't a whole lot to write home about. It was the dirtiest, darkest, nastiest bars, which I absolutely loved for whatever reason, because I could just be the pig that I was, and it didn't bother anybody. I've wrecked several cars, you know, and never got a bruise out of any of them, knock on wood. Got my first DUI in 1985, and I was just barely over the legal limit, but, you know, it wasn't until after I'd sobered up for several years that I could look back on it, and it really hit me, like, that, you know, I only got arrested twice for drinking and driving, but had I been arrested every time I drove drunk, I'd have 2,000 of them, you know. I was definitely a mobile drunk. And I do remember toward the end of my drinking, my mom had sent me a newspaper article out of the Detroit newspaper, and it was about this guy who would come home every night drunk, and he pull his car in the driveway, come in the house, pass out right on the living room floor. You know, his wife would clean him all up, and, you know, he would do all kind of, you know, everything would come out of every hole in his body, and she'd clean him all up and wake him up the next morning, get him to work, you know, and she got tired of that after a while. I guess she started going to Al-Anon or something, and, you know, one day she just left him laying there, you know, and then the next day he got up, he was all scared, and, you know, he hurried up, cleaned himself up. He got out and got in his car, backed out of the garage, and he gets to the bottom of the driveway, and his wife wasn't practicing her program good enough or something. She felt bad he didn't have his lunch, so she runs out onto the porch to give him his lunch, and he sees her, and she just falls, you know, and he puts the car in park, runs up to the porch, tries reviving her, and he looks back at his car, and there was an 8-year-old girl wedged into the grill of his car that, and he never knew he hit her, you know. Now that could have happened to me every time I drove drunk. And I didn't care, or I didn't even think about it. I didn't. One of my favorite sayings when I was drinking was, "That'll never happen to me. You know, this will never happen to me." And thank God that didn't happen. But you know, it was January 14th, 1988. Night like any other night. Rob was going out into town to impress all the ladies, and which. That didn't happen, by the way, very often. But, I have vague memories of standing around this table looking all cool, you know, and then falling down or something. And, you know, those are the kind of things that happen to me. I mean, I do remember sitting in a bar one night, and everybody's laughing because I'd, like, sitting along the wall, there was, like, a bench, and I guess I'd passed out and wet myself, and... yeah, I mean, that was fun. You know, I had a lot of fun out there drinking, you know. Today I know it's like, from hearing you people talk, I mean, you know, these are the prices that I was willing to pay. Because as crazy as all that stuff was, in my life, my drinking was not crazy compared to a lot of people's I've heard, but it was crazy enough for me, and, you know, today I know it's because I didn't feel good when I wasn't drinking, you know. Drinking was my solution, you know. I didn't know any of that. I really didn't know that until 2 years ago, after 19 years of being in this program. If I ever did, I don't remember it. But, you know, it is what gave me that sense of ease and comfort, you know. That, you know, and... January 14th, 1988, I got my second DUI, and I came home that night. I called my mom up for whatever reason, and poured whatever beer I was drinking down the drain. I haven't had one since, you know. I immediately threw myself into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I became a meeting maker, because, you know, that's what people talked about up there, and I think we talk about that everywhere, and then it works. Meeting makers make meetings. Some meeting makers actually stay sober a long time. I'm one of them, you know. I know of about 5 or 6 up in my area. There's a lot of meeting makers with a lot of short-time sobriety, but, you know, for the most part, you know, these 5 or 6 guys that are still around up there, we all had the same sponsor, You know, I got a sponsor right off the bat, and we went through the steps, and I really don't remember a whole lot about going through the steps with him, other than when I did my fifth step with him. He told me I was a people pleaser, which, okay, I didn't know what to do with that. excuse me. And that was about it. I don't remember going through any more of the steps with this guy, but I was just always going to meetings, and I was active in service, and you know, I want to get right up to 2 years ago, because you know, at 19 years sober, I was fairly happy in this program. I mean, if I wasn't, I wouldn't have stuck around for 19 years. You know, I was always pretty friendly. I liked, you know, setting up camping trips, whitewater rafting trips, and taking a bunch of sober people with me. And, you know, I liked surrounding myself with you guys. And I always reached out to the newcomer, you know, and I'd tell you, you know, do this thing. And then I'd walk away, because I really didn't know what else to tell you. Actually, you know, I think I gave my number out thousands of times, you know, and if anybody ever, like, asked me to sponsor him, the first thing I would tell them is, you know, write out 100 reasons why you want to come to AA and why you don't want to drink anymore. Now, my sponsor didn't show me that. It's just something I came up with, because I know how this thing works, you know. And I now see the reason I did that, the reason I would make up all this other stuff, is because it worked really well at getting you to leave me alone. Nobody's going to do that. And then, you know, some of these guys surprised me, and they actually would, and I'm like, oh, now what do I do, you know? And I think I heard one fifth step in my first 19 years of sobriety, and that scared me, because a guy took a guy's life, you know, and I didn't know what to do with that, you know. And I called my sponsor, and he says, "Wow, you're getting broke in quick. I've had 5 of those." I'm like, you know, I think that scared me, and I didn't want to do that anymore. But come to find out, this guy was just being dramatic. He didn't do anything like that. He just was trying to impress me, I guess. I don't know. But anyways, 2 years ago, I walk into a meeting up in my hometown. You know, and because of that first 19 years of sobriety, it did allow me to complete my Navy career. You know, I was able to, you know, I came into this program because I was in fear of losing that career, for one thing. And this program did allow me to maintain staying in the military for 20 years, and, you know, I retired in 1998, and, you know, I got a lot of good things, you know, in the first 19 years. I don't want to minimize that, but, you know, 2 years ago, I walked into a meeting like any other night back home. It was just going to be another night. Now, I really didn't, I came here because I just didn't have nothing better to do, you know. That's just what it became, my habit of what I do on my night times, you know. And I walk into this meeting, and there's this guy getting ready to chair the meeting who I knew when I first sobered up. But something was different about him. Noticeably different, you know. This guy had this sparkle in his eyes, and he actually said, "Hello, Rob, how you doing?" You know, and he never said that to me before. He's like, you know, him and I for 19 years, he moved away about 3 years after I sobered up, and then he'd pop back in every couple years, and, you know, it was mostly like this, you know, sup, and that was it, you know. But when I walked in this time, it was like he was glad to see me, and I could see something. And the reason it was the what's up is because, you know, I came in here with a lot of other primary purposes, you know. And I'm not proud of that today, but, you know, he had the same kind of primary purpose, and he was getting in the way of my primary purpose, you know. And, okay, we'll just move on. Y'all know what I'm talking about. I need to go any further. All right, so he spoke. You know, what I heard this guy say was that his life had purpose and direction today. Now I'm sitting there at 19 years sober, and I'm going, well, what is my purpose? I have no clue, you know. I know where he's talking about getting this direction from, but I really felt like I didn't have any direction in my life, you know. And he talked about, you know, helping others is his primary purpose today. you know, and all of a sudden I heard the preamble being read at 10,000-15,000 meetings I'd been to in 19 years. And that we say that at the end of every preamble, and I'm like, that has never been my primary purpose, you know, stay sober and help another alcoholic. Come on. You know, whatever this guy said that night, it just hit me hard, and I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, I gotta have what you got going on here. And he lives in Boston, you know, and I'm up in Brunswick, Maine, and I'm like, I didn't even worry about how this would or wouldn't work. You know, over the years, I'd hear these speakers come around, and these circus speaker guys, you know, and I'm like, man, how come nobody in my meeting is talking like these guys, you know? Because, you know, if that guy lived in my town, he'd be my sponsor, but there's nobody around my groups talking like these guys talk, you know? And those were hit and miss. I didn't get to see a lot of that stuff where I was at, but anyways, I went up to him, and he says, all right, he says, you know, read the doctor's opinion, call me tomorrow, you know? And, so I did, you know, I just read the doctor's opinion and called him. And, you know, we got together the next day, and, you know, a couple months later, you know, we drove, like, from Maine down to Baltimore and back up through Lehigh Valley, I think he spoke about a year and a half ago, and then back up through Boston. We were on a road for, you know, a few days, and it was really good to spend that time with him. It was going to be, I was going to speak at his meeting in Baltimore, and I'm in the car all day long trying to think of what I'm going to say. You know, I'm like, oh my God, because I'm nervous, because I know the kind of people these people had been hearing at these meetings that I was supposed to be speaking at that night, you know. And I'm like, man, I suck at this, you know. All right, I'm going to tell him this. And I'm just, the car was like silent all day long, and I about had it down, you know, I was just going to, you know, just walk people through. I'm just going to share what he shared with me. I'm just going to walk somebody through the steps, you know. And he goes, hey, Rob, no matter what you do tonight, just don't walk people through the steps, because that's, like, really boring. No. And then for the next 2.5 hours, I'm like, I can't do it tonight. I can't, man. I won't do it, man. I was nervous. Oh, I still am, man. When I first started hanging around him 2 years ago and going around to these meetings he was taking me to, I was like, man, I can't wait till I can go up. And, you know, God, I can't wait till guys like Jeff ask me to come speak at their group and everything. And then I'm coming here tonight, I'm like, man, I don't want to do this. You know, this is definitely not my favorite thing to do, you know. And what I say from this podium, I know today is not the most important thing I do for this program. You know, it's what I'm doing outside of this room and, you know, what I do on a daily basis, you know. And my hope is that, you know, I can get out of the way enough up here and let my higher power speak through me, that, you know, that just maybe one or two people out here that might be hurting and I can hear something that will help them. You know, we went through the steps pretty rapidly, you know, and I'm going to touch on just a few things that I noticed or saw going through the steps this time, because they were profound. They had a profound effect on me. You know, the first thing he told me was what his job as a sponsor was. You know, and before that even, he says, Rob, you need to do a couple things here as we go through this. Just keep an open mind. Now, I've heard that a million times, you know. And he says, and let go of all your old ideas. And that's another thing I'd heard a million times. Now, how am I going to do it this time any different than I've ever done it before, you know? But I just thought about it. I said, okay, well, whatever that means is what I'm going to try and do. Next thing he said, he goes, Rob, my only job as your sponsor is to show you what my sponsor showed me. And he goes, you know, I'm not a banker, so if you got money problems, don't talk to me about them. You know, he goes, well, before that, you know, I tried to sit there and tell him all about my money problems and my girlfriend problems and my life problems and blah, blah, blah. And he's like, shh, shh, shh. You know, he goes, I don't care, Rob. I don't need to hear any of this because I hear it every day. I already know. He goes, you wouldn't be sitting here right now if all that wasn't going on. He goes, what do you want to do about it? You know, nobody had ever been that direct with me, you know. But he said, you know, I'm not your counselor, I'm not going to sit here and, you know, he goes, you want to talk to somebody about all your problems, Rob, go pay the counselor $100 an hour. I'm not charging money, so I don't want to hear it, you know. He might not have said exact those words. I'm kind of paraphrasing a little bit here, but he just said, you know, I'm not a banker. Got money problems, talk to a banker. He goes, you know, I'm not a lawyer. If you got legal problems, go hire a lawyer, you know. He goes, I am a drunk, you know. I cannot manage my life, so don't ask me to manage yours. He says, my only job is to help you find out what's blocking you from your higher power. And he goes, and the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to walk you through these steps. And if you take the actions that these steps are showing us to take, he goes, your ego will be minimized to the extent that I will then be able to place your hand in the hand of a power that you understand, a higher power that you understand. And at that point, Rob, he goes, you will become God-dependent and God-reliant. You won't be dependent upon me. You won't be relying upon me. And all of a sudden, I thought about what my first 19 years in this program was all about. You know, sponsorship was call me every day. You know, if you got a problem, you call me with all your problems. And, you know, and it was like, you know, he went on and he said, he started talking about the history of AA a little bit, you know, and when he started doing that, I wanted to interject what I knew of the history, and I immediately caught myself and said, quiet, Rob, just listen to this guy. But when he went through, you know, the Washingtonians and the Oxford groups and these organizations that basically lived the life, you know, had principles guiding their way of life, you know, the 12 steps of this program are just principles. They're spiritual truths. Nobody had ever told me that. Or if they did, I didn't hear it again. But he said, you know, what's a principle, Rob? He goes, a principle is a fundamental truth. You know, it is a, he goes, it's just like gravity. He goes, gravity doesn't care if you believe in it. Doesn't care if you agree with it, understand it, like it or not, it applies, period. It's a principle. And he says, you can get up on the roof of this building and say, gravity, I don't believe you, I don't trust you, I don't agree with you, I don't like you, and I can jump off and gravity will apply, period. It's a principle. You know, and I can take an ant and I can take an elephant up there with me and we can all jump off at the same time. We're all going to hit the ground at the exact same time. You know, it's a principle. And he says, spiritual principles are the exact same thing. You know, they don't care if we believe in them, agree with them, understand them. He says they will apply. He says the only difference between these physical life principles and spiritual principles, Rob, is he goes, you know, you can't explain this spiritual stuff. It don't make sense, you know. And for some reason or other, all these things that he was telling me made sense. Or they were hitting me here, you know. I just knew this guy was just telling me the truth. You know, he wasn't trying to play a big shot. You know, he wasn't trying to act like he knew more than me, or he wasn't talking down to me. And he was just was sharing the exact same thing his sponsor shared with him. You know, and we went through the steps. You know, and I'm not going to get into all this stuff. You know. I will tell you that, you know, in the third step prayer for the first time, and I've said that prayer a million times, I always thought that part about, you know, taking away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help with the power of the Lord, all that. I always thought that that meant, you know, God, please take away my difficulties so that I don't have any more difficulties, you know, and then if you do that, maybe, you know, I'll do your will. Or whatever, you know. And when I read it this time, I saw that I'm asking God to take these difficulties away so they can help somebody else. I'm like, duh. Wow, I didn't know, ever didn't see that, you know. That had must have been something about the open mind thing. I don't know. But, you know, and he did tell me, too. He goes, you know, Rob, he goes, God will remove your difficulties just to the extent that you let him and go about doing his work. You know? See, I always thought I had to wait for him to take him away so that then I could help people. And he said, you have it backwards, Rob. He goes, you got to, like, reach out there and just try to be helpful to another human being. And just the extent that you do that, will he remove him? And I just trusted what my sponsor was saying, and we moved on. And I wrote out a fourth step. You know, and before I did that fourth step this time, you know, he reminded me about the part in the big book talks about I'm an actor that wants to run the whole show. I want to be the director. I want to do everything. You know, if the world would just do what Rob wants them to do, I'll be happy. You know, but unfortunately, the world doesn't want to do what Rob wants them to do. You know, and for the first time, it's like I can see that. That's me playing God. If you're not doing what I want, you know, anytime you upset me, I saw this before I ever started writing my fourth step this time. That, you know, the world just wasn't doing what I wanted them to do, which meant I was playing God. It was like I was in charge, and you know, you do this, you do that, you don't do this and do that, and if you do that, then I'll be happy. And people don't listen to me, you know, and then I get pissed, you know, and it's kind of all like flowed in when he was talking about that before I took my fourth step. And the next page talks about selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our choice. He says, Robert says, we think, we don't know, because maybe we'll prove, maybe we won't. It's like a theory, you know. So my troubles, I think, are my own making. He goes, it's another theory. We don't know. Maybe we'll prove, maybe we won't. I had some kind of, you know, inkling that, you know, it was probably true already. But, you know, I wrote out the fourth step again, and he gave me 2.5 hours to do it, and that kind of threw me for a shock. I'm like, no, no, no. You know, 4 months minimum for a fourth step. You know, because that was my experience. You know, I've been going, I was a meeting maker, man. I went to meetings daily for 19 years, and I never heard of anybody doing a fourth step in 2.5 hours, 3 hours. Come on, that's ridiculous. How thorough can that be, you know? You know, and that's what he told me. And again, you know, I don't know, I wanted what this guy had, and if anything I'd learned in the first 19 years, though, if you want what we got, do what we do. So I was going to do what he did. So I went home, I said a prayer, and I started writing, you know, and I spent like an hour and a half that night, and like 2 hours the next night, and I was done. You know, and I wrote about my resentments, and I wrote about my fears, and I wrote about my sex conduct. You know, and I called him up, and he met me the next day. You know, so one thing I noticed with this guy, he was always available the second I was ready to move forward. You know, he did not say, you know, I'll meet you a week from Thursday. How about that? You know, like, you know, no, these guys knew that the window of opportunity in this program sometimes is very small, very small. And, you know, if I'm not available for that person who's ready to move forward with this thing, you know that's like my sponsors talk about, you know, it's like I can be seconds and inches away from taking a totally different turn that I don't want to go today, you know. And he was available. He was available. We got together. We did that fifth step, and I saw perfectly clear this time how there was some form of self-centered fear behind absolutely every single resentment I had. Totally clear. You know, I mean, I've heard the fourth column, fourth step, and the fifth and eighth column, fourth steps. One, I had one sponsee come over about a year after I went through these steps, and he had this, I don't know where he got it from, man, but it was like 58 columns, his fourth step. And I was like, all right, well, we'll do it, you know. But, you know, that third column to me is what a lot of people refer to, this fourth column, you know. Where was I at fault? This is my inventory, not the other man's, you know. You know, that third column's all about me. My self-esteem, my security, my me. I could see the selfishness, you know. And just, you know, by some chance, if I wouldn't have had that fear around that, I would have never had the resentment. I saw that. So when I finished my fifth step this time, he sent me home for my hour, like the big book suggests. It's like, the root of all this stuff is fear. You know, all the other times I studied the big book and studied the 12 and 12 and went to a million meetings studying this thing, it just complicated it for me. It made it so I always thought I had to have the perfect list of absolutely every single character defect that I had, so I knew exactly what to ask God to remove in the seventh step. And I was never going to complete that list because I just never knew enough yet to give that list to God so he would take, you know, I'm like, Then this time I could see, you know what? If I didn't have any fear, if that were feasible, I would not have any character defects. None. You know? Yeah, I'm not going to lie to you unless I'm afraid to tell you the truth, you know? I'm not going to steal from you unless I'm afraid I don't have enough, you know? I'm not going to be jealous unless I'm afraid you're going to take my girlfriend, you know what I mean? It's like, I just thought that you name one. I cannot come up with a negative behavior that does not have some form of fear behind it. So that made steps 6 and 7 really. Am I now ready to let God take that stuff away? You know, absolutely. This time I saw it, I'm like, why? That stuff has absolutely done me no good. It's just caused me every bit of problems I've ever had in my life. Absolutely. If he can take it away, I'm letting him. You know? So I did the 7-step prayer. And, you know, and again, here's another one. You know, it says, you know, I'm now ready. You should remove every single defect of character so that everybody likes me. I'm really cool. You know? Doesn't it say that? You know? That's what I thought it said, or that's the way I was interpreting it to say, but for some reason or another, when I saw it this time, it said something about, take away that stuff that's standing in the way of me from helping another person. And I'm like, wow, you know? And again, the only thing that's standing in the way from me helping somebody else is my selfishness. I'm way too busy to help you. You know, there's way too many other things I'd like to be doing than sitting down trying to help you, you know. And again, my sponsor told me, he goes, Rob, you know, don't get this one backwards either. You know, don't wait around for God to take away these character defects and then go help somebody. He goes, go help somebody and let God work on this stuff. You know, I don't even pay attention to my character defects anymore. It's not my job anymore. I always thought I had to work on them, you know. I worked on them for 19 years and I never changed. When I went through these steps this time, I didn't really notice any change in me, but I had people coming up to me going, what are you doing, Rob? Will you show me what you're doing? You know, nobody ever asked me that stuff. And I've heard so many speakers talk about their amends and how amazing they are. I have not had the most amazing amends stories to talk to you about. You know, I get to hear the guys that I hang around with today talk about their amazing amends, and that's good enough for me, you know. But I did get to make amends to my mother who's got Alzheimer's, you know, she, at this point, she really couldn't comprehend about anything, you know, but I sat her down and I asked her, and I said, Mom, you know, there's something I'd really like to talk to you about if you got a few minutes, you know, and it's like, she snapped out, she goes, absolutely, word that, I didn't even hear that word, and she wasn't able to pronounce a word before that for a year and a half. It's like she knew what I was doing, you know, and we sat down, and I was able to just tell her, I haven't been the son, I've never been the son that I wanted to be, you know. I caused that woman so much pain, and I never saw it, you know. I remember calling her from New York City 2 weeks before I quit drinking. You know, I'm on a payphone, you know, doing the nice son thing, calling my parents, let her know I'm okay. But no, I'm sitting there saying, hang on, Mom, somebody's grabbing my wallet. Whoa, 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 and I'm making this up. I'm like, why? I mean, why? You know, and I don't know if she ever even remembered stuff like that. Obviously today she doesn't, but you know I caused a lot of fear for her. And when I finished making my amends to her, you know, it's like she just had tears in her eyes and just said, keep doing what you're doing, you know. And then she was gone again. You know, that's about my most amazing amends. I love that I had. I'll tell you one of the guys that I sponsored, because he says I could share it. A friend of mine, 13 years sober, you know. I ran into him one day at the base. I hadn't seen him in like 5 years at the base. I work on the Navy base still up in Maine. And he's in the Navy also, you know. And I hadn't seen him in like 5 years. I come out of my office and he's sitting there. And I'm like, how you doing, John? Good, good, good. And not good, you know. And then we end up going to have dinner. And to make a long story short, you know, when I told him that, he said he needed to talk to me, and you know, we went to dinner that night, and he proceeded to tell me that he currently had built two bombs that were in his room in the barracks, and he's getting ready to send them to his ex-wife and the judge the next day. And this is a 13-year sober guy. I'm like, okay, what do we do with this one, you know? I can't do nothing. God, what do I do with this one, you know? And, well, first thing we had to do was get rid of the bombs, you know? Anyway, we took care of all that, all right? And I took him through the steps again. And he was able to make amends to his mother, who gave him up for adoption when he was 5 years old, and he hadn't seen her in 33 years. 13 years sober, he never saw the resentment he had toward his mother, you know? And not only his resentment toward her, but how his stubborn resentment kept him from ever letting his mother just know that he's okay. Yeah, and possibly there are some women out there, mothers who have given up their kids for adoption, who would rather not know. But today I know the truth. You know, the fundamental truth. The principle is that a mother cannot not wonder what's up with their child. I don't care how sick they are. I don't care how spiritually bankrupt they are. They care about their child. They can't not, you know. And he did some internet search, and he found her back in St. Louis, Missouri. You know, he got on a plane, he flew back out there and spent 2 weeks with her. And he said when the door opened, she flew out that door, threw her arms around him, and he, you know, she knew it was him, you know. I mean, she knew he was coming in within a few days, but the rest of his family, cousins and stuff, said, let's not tell her, let's make it a surprise. But I met him down in Boston, you know, when he came back off that little trip, and he's all excited and stoked, and he's sitting there, and my sponsor's standing next to me, and he's telling us this story about reconnecting with his family and these people he hadn't seen in so many years, and my sponsor going, geez, he goes, I was just in a meeting last week, and there was this woman talking about giving her kid up for adoption when she was 5 years old, and blah, 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 and then this other girl raises her hand, she says, I got given up for adoption when I was 5 years old, and blah, blah, blah. And he goes, and then the two people, everybody in the meeting started looking at these two and realized, it's mother-daughter, and they were reunited. You know, these are the kind of things that I have been exposed to in this last 2 years. And that's one of many, 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 many things, you know. I know there's guys in this room who, you know, who have had that same experience, you know. A good buddy of mine was just up sharing a few weeks ago in Brunswick, and he was talking about, you know, when these guys drive up from Boston to share at my meeting, you know, I usually call them on their way home to make sure they're okay. And this one guy called him up. He was like about an hour and a half toward getting home or whatever, and I said, so how's your trip, Sean? Oh, it's good. He goes, me and God, we're hovering about 85 miles an hour all the way, and I'm like, I said, Sean, I don't think God hovers. I think God hovers about 65. And he's like, oh, no, no, we're good, we're good. So we talked like 15 minutes, and he was talking about how, you know, he gets so tired every time he comes to an AA meeting and as a speaker, and he wants to talk about all the great things that have happened in his sobriety, and he ends up wasting all his time on the drinking part and blah, blah, blah. You know, we finished our conversation, and he said, wow. He goes, Rob, he goes, I just got done talking to you, okay, for 15 minutes. He goes, my car is so loud that I had to slow down to hear you. And he says, it just so happens the speed at which that occurs is about 65 miles an hour. And he goes, I just saw the first cop I've seen all the way to Maine and back, you know. And I'm like, those are the things that blow me away. They're, you know, and then dawned on me why we don't tell all these fantastic things, you know, because when I first came in here, somebody was telling me that kind of stuff, I'm going, fuck this guy. If that's what I got to look forward to, no thanks, you know. But you'll find it eventually. I went through the rest of these steps. 10 and 11 are like the most amazing steps that I never touched in 19 years, you know, because they were like my great-grand sponsor talks about meditation, you know, he I can't do that. My hip would get thrown out, you know. And I've tried that for years, you know, just the, you know, the whole home, you know, put the music on, light the candles and the incense, and I get up and I go, you know, I'm like, it just never worked, you know, for me. And this time my sponsor took me through it. He goes, Rob, look at that, those two pages, 87, 88, he goes, step 11. He's talking about thinking and thoughts and think, you know, thought life. And he says, Rob, just start paying attention to your thoughts. You know, what are you thinking about today? You know, and it asks God. Yeah, it tells me in the morning when I get up. You know, I prayed for 19 years. God, please keep me sober today. You know, because everybody told me that that's what they were doing, and so I did it. You know, I want what you guys got. I'm going to do what you did. So I would pray to God, please help me stay. I haven't asked God to keep me sober for 2 years now. You know, I know He wants me sober. You know, every action I take, every word that comes out of my mouth, every footstep I take, my higher power sees it. You know, I don't think He cares my own opinion. My higher power doesn't care. You know, if I can give Him a whole 10 minutes of my day, you know, I give Him a whole day. You know, I am totally an employee today. You know, and I don't do that perfect all the time, but when I'm doing it, I feel awesome. Whenever I'm feeling anything but awesome, I'm not doing it. But for the most part, I feel pretty awesome quite a bit today, you know, because I do what the big book suggests. I do what those first 100 people did. You know, I get up in the morning, I ask God to direct my thinking, you know, especially divorcing from selfish, dishonest, self-seeking motives, you know. And as I go through the day, I ask God, I say, you know what, I'm going to get agitated today, God, and if you would, please, if I do get agitated, will you please help me to pause and not react, you know, and I do that today, you know, not immediately a lot, you know, I don't have to do it a whole lot today, but, you know, when I do, when I ask God for the right thought or action, to me it's always step 10, Rob. Well, there's a novel idea. I thought step 10 was every night. I have these literally stacks of notebooks around my house with these inventories on them, you know, continue to take personal inventory. You know, so I'd go home, go to bed at night, and I'd draw three columns. I'd go, I'm resentful. Who was I resentful at today? What was I afraid of today? Screw that. Who's got the time for that? You know, I wasn't getting any. Well, I wasn't getting anything out of doing that. Just a bunch of half-filled-up notebooks, you know. And my sponsor this time told me, showed me specifically where it says, you know, continue to watch for resentment, dishonesty, selfishness, and fear. Boom. That's it. And when they happen, do these four things. Ask God to remove it now, you know, immediately, not in an hour from now. If I wait an hour, I'm in trouble. The second I recognize it, when I'm agitated, step 11, I ask God to take it away, because I can't. I've tried so hard my whole life to fix this stuff, and it don't work. I ask God to remove it, you know. I talk to somebody about it once, you know. If I've caused any harm, I make amends immediately. And then the toughest thing is the fourth thing, which I have to do every time. Resolutely turn my thoughts to somebody I can help. And my grand sponsor says, you know, he goes, when I read this big book through the eyes of a man who wants to be helpful to another human being, the words will take on a whole different meaning than when I read that big book through the eyes of a man who just wants to get happy. Because, you know, that's all I wanted for the first 19 years. I just wanted to get happy, okay? And I really didn't care about that much about what I could do for other people. But, you know, and step 11 says, you know, at the end of the night, I got to review my day. Where was I resentful, dishonest, selfish, and afraid? I said, wow, that sounds familiar. Wait, that's the stuff I'm supposed to be doing with step 10 all day long. And, you know, if I can answer to my satisfaction those questions every night when I go to bed, I can put my head on my pillow and I am asleep. You know, I asked my sponsor that. I said, how do you do this step 11 thing every night? He said, you know what, Rob, if I put my head on my pillow at night and I fall asleep, it was a good day. You know, I'm aware when my day did not go according to my higher power's will because I can't sleep. And I'm just tossing and turning, you know. Step 12 has been an absolutely amazing thing. I finished these steps and my sponsor says, Rob, just go show somebody what I just showed you. You know, I didn't do anything I learned in the first 19 years. You know, I just did what this guy showed me in the last 2 weeks. He says, go find somebody, show him. You know, I went to a meeting that night and I was talking to a buddy of mine, but then I see some guy walk across the road and he's by himself staring at the ground. And I just went up to him and I said, welcome. You know, I told him who I was, you know, is he new to the area? And had he, you know, he said he'd been around before, he's just coming back. And I said, you know, if you don't have a sponsor, I said, I'm willing to help you out. You know, you don't have to feel like this anymore, you know. And he became my first sponsee, you know. And man, you know, 2 months later, I'm getting accused of sponsee collecting, you know. Cause, I mean, really, now, how can anyone sponsor 35 guys, you know? How? No way if you're doing what we do in our area, where I come from, for so long. You know, if I had to take 35 phone calls a day and listen to 35 people's problems all day long, I couldn't do it. You know, it ain't happening, you know. But if they call me and I say, call God first, this is local call, ask him the same question you want to ask me and then call me back. Okay. They call me back, I say, what do you say? You know? And they tell me, I go, well, I couldn't have come up with that. That's great. It is so simple. And if they call me up and they still got all the problems, I don't know. I can't. Jeff, I had this guy. You know, he's just calling me with all the problems. And I called Jeff, and he's just laughing on the phone. You know, he's like, isn't that crazy? All these guys want you to manage their lives. We can't manage our own. You know, I mean, it's like, I can't. You know, I don't know. God does a great job when I let him, you know. And me letting him is simply just making, being of service to other people my primary purpose today. It comes before anything, you know. And I had people say, Rob, you got to take care of yourself because, you know, you'll get sick, you know. I was telling my buddies today, you know, the other day, I was like, you know, if I died tomorrow doing what I'm doing, I'm going to go in peace. You know, I'm not so worried about what happens to me today. You know, I don't do this like my grand sponsor. I don't do this well, but I do it with my heart. You know, I do it consistently. You know, that is a huge word for me. I never did anything in my life consistently that was of any value or good to anybody else, you know. But remarkable things happen, you know, and it is the simplest thing. And it doesn't, you don't have to have 19 years of sober for this to be simple. I've seen guys with 2 months, 3 months sober, you know, do the same things I did, and they get the exact same results. And they're already turning around and helping other people. You know, and the joy that I see in their eyes today, you know, that's how God is revealing himself to me today, through these guys, you know. And, you know, I want to thank my buddy Kurt and Mickey for taking this trip with me the last 2 days, you know, because that's what this trip's all about. It wasn't even about me being here talking to you guys for this hour. You know, it's about the time that me and these other two guys are going to spend on the way home tomorrow, you know. And, you know, so if you're in here tonight and you're feeling like something's missing, you know, I know what that feels like, you know, and you're so close to not feeling like that if you take some simple actions. And I know there's plenty of people in this room that are willing to show you that. Again, I want to thank you guys for having me up and listening to me blab for an hour. I look forward to meeting some of you guys again sometime in the future. Thanks.